A stunning comeback for a Philippine political dynasty. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. won the presidency more than 30 years after his father was pushed out from power. But will he unify the nation or bring back his father's controversial legacy? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I am Hashim Ahlbarra. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has been inaugurated as President of the Philippines. His father was a controversial leader, Ferdinand Marcos Sr., who was forced out of office in a 1986 popular uprising. Many say he was an autocratic leader who killed, jailed or disappeared thousands of opponents during his 21 years in office. And more than 30 years since his father fled the Philippines, his son is now in power after winning a landslide victory promising to tackle inflation and a struggling economy. But will his father's legacy prove too much of a challenge? We'll bring in our guests in a moment. First, this report from Jamila Alindugan in Manila.
Si Ferdinand Romualdez.
After more than 30 years, the rehabilitation of the Marcos name in the Philippines is nearly complete. Bongbong Marcos Jr., the only son and namesake of the country's late dictator, is now its next president after winning an unprecedented 31 million votes. The Marcoses are considered one of the most infamous political families in Asia, and their name has long been synonymous with decadence and abuse of power. They ruled the Philippines from 1965 until 1986, when they were ousted through a people power revolution.
The President of the Republic of the Philippines.
His inauguration on Thursday is noticeably more grand than those of his predecessors, Aquino and Duterte. There is more parade and pomp than usual, but his speech focused less on nostalgia and more on reconciliation.
We will build back better by doing things in the light of the experiences that we have had, both good and bad. It doesn't matter. No looking back in anger or nostalgia. In the road ahead, the immediate months will be rough, but I will walk that road with you.
The Marcos resurgence is the result of a decades-long, well-funded campaign to revise history. In this year's election, online propaganda, coupled with the Marcos family's vast wealth and their alliance with Duterte, paved the way for his presidency.
But his administration is expected to face a tough road ahead. The country is facing its worst economic crisis in decades. Its education and public health systems are in shambles, and society is deeply polarized.
Marcos Duterte!
Across the capital, several activists have been arrested by police, an all-too-familiar scene during his father's regime. But historians say although the past has a way of catching up with the present, the country's future under Marcos Jr. has yet to be written. And so there is little choice but to give it a chance to unfold. Jamila Alindugan, Al Jazeera, Manila.
Let's bring in our guests in Manila. Richard Hedarian, columnist at the Philippine Daily Inquirer. In Denver, Alvin Kamba, assistant professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies, University of Denver. In the Philippine city of Marikina, Danilo Arau, a convener at the election watchdog Contradaya. Welcome to the program. Richard, what does the revival of the Marcos political dynasty mean for the Philippines?
Well, in many ways, this marks decades-long frustration of ordinary people with the dysfunctions of the supposedly democratic system that replaced the Marcos dictatorship after 1986. I mean, that revolution was supposed to bring about a progressive order. Yet what happened was the liberal oligarchs in the country, what happens was political dynasties in the countries co-opted that revolution, and hence we had a lot of dysfunctions. I mean, the Philippines has one of the most concentrated growths on earth. 40 richest families to come 76% of newly created growth in 2011. Up to 83% of the Philippine Congress is dominated by political dynasties. I mean, these are mind-boggling numbers. And of course, the pandemic in recent years has also made the poverty gains and the developmental gains also, they were reversed in many ways. So the return of the Marcoses is really a counter-revolution. It's a way by which the Marcoses were able to exploit people's frustration with what replaced their father's regime. And now they're back in power in alliance with the Dutertes, who still remain really, really potent force in Philippine politics.
Mm-hmm. Alvin, this is someone who is going to face huge challenges ahead. But given the landslide victory, do you think that he will feel enough confident to pursue an aggressive political agenda?
I feel like he will likely be able to push back against sort of this like potential backlash against his policies. He was elected with 31 million of Filipino voters. He has a strong base. There's a strong coalition of elites around him, and you know he will likely focus on having his own take of policies that are somewhat a spin-off the Duterte policy. So in an independent foreign policy, a focus on infrastructure and a strong state against the opposition. Of course, it's going to be a bit different. He will reward a different set of elites and he will focus on a different set of agendas to some degree. But I think he will have some degree of popular mandate to push forward his own policies, relatively autonomous from, I would say, a potential public backlash.
Danilo, this is someone who is going to be haunted by the legacy of his father, Ferdinand Marcos Sr. However, he's not willing to distance himself from that legacy, or at least denounce it, which is going to create some confusion among those who suffered under the era of his father.
Yes, that's true. Disinformation is the name of the game right now, and there seems to be the normalization of fake news, not to mention the institutionalization of repression. Of course, it's true, Richard mentions the frustration of people, but we have to also take into account the fact that the Marcoses have prepared for this for more than 30 years now. They really intend to make a comeback to Malacanang, and they did so not because of their sincerity for them to be given a chance, but for them to arrogantly arrogate upon themselves a narrative that is really close to fiction, something that's a parallel universe in a multiverse of madness, if you don't mind my saying that. It's mainly because of the disinformation, mainly because of historical denialism and red tagging. And that's why there's a need to fight back and to push back.
Mm-hmm. Richard, explain this to us. I mean, you have a new president whose father was accused of plundering almost $10 billion during his reign. And the family itself has been involved in tax evasion schemes. Still, people seem to forget those things and say, you know what, let's move ahead with the Marcos family.
Yes, I mean, I completely agree with Danilo and a lot of journalists and colleagues who emphasize the role of disinformation. But there was a reason why I emphasize systemic frustration, because disinformation is there in many countries all around the world. In fact, if you look at misperception index, for instance, the levels of disinformation in the Philippines is similar to Colombia, to Mexico, to Brazil, and yet those countries keep on electing more progressive leaders than the Philippines. So we're forgetting, for instance, the dysfunctions of the opposition in the Philippines, lack of unity among them. But more importantly, we're also forgetting the fact that disinformation is people are most receptive to disinformation if the educational system is not inculcating the critical thinking that will help them to sift through disinformation. Disinformation is more appealing to people if people, for instance, are frustrated with the system and don't see any prospect for breakout reforms, for instance. So I think to look at just disinformation alone, you're missing. You're just scratching the surface and you're not looking at structural factors that are coming into picture. Not to mention, as I said, had, for instance, Sara Duterte, the presidential daughter, former presidential daughter, had she decided to run for the presidency, I'm not sure if Marcos Jr. would have even stayed in the race, never mind winning 58% of the vote. So that alliance with the Dutertes was also a very important contingent factor that made him victorious. But nonetheless, correct, I agree with Alvin that Marcos will try to play his own game. I mean, clearly, he's trying to be his own man. If you look at his cabinet appointments, he's putting a lot of loyalists, trusted mm-hmm. advisors, traditionalists there. So he's trying to also show that he can be independent from other houses, including the House of Duterte, and try to be, in his way at least, a unifying leader focusing on economic recovery and infrastructure development.
Alvin, to break down this path towards the presidency, was the Marcos family taking advantage of what Richard said, basically, which is a long frustration with a dysfunctional political establishment, or was it a family that knew how to use social media in a way or another to reinvent itself? Because ultimately, when you have younger generation voting, they tend to forget the past.
It's a bit of both. I mean, Danilo and Richard are both correct on this. Like, structurally speaking, you cannot disentangle disinformation and education and, let's say, the political mobilization of a family from the structural context where it exists. The Philippines is, as what Richard said, the rise of the the comeback of the liberals in the 1980s, the 1980s, and the failure of steering government towards meaningful reforms. At the same time, while you have this polarization in sort of the Philippine context, you do have political maneuvers going on as well. I do want to highlight what Richard said, and I completely agree with this. The role of education is extremely important, and a couple of social scientists have come up with the idea that, oh, you know, if you take a look at the people who voted for Marcos, you have college-educated people voting for Marcos, you have people with master's degrees, you have people with PhDs, in some sort of data set. They sort of create this idea that education is not a factor. And I disagree with this, because a lot of the studies that say that education is not a factor, they use data sets that look at education in terms of categories, like primary, secondary, and tertiary. But I bet if we have a better data set that looks at the quality of education, then we could actually say that education is indeed a major factor as to why people voted for Marcos.
Mm-hmm. Danilo, the few days before the inauguration, the government decided to shut down the news website Rappler. Is this something which is likely to be further consolidated by Marcos, or do you think that he will be under pressure to reinstate it back?
To some extent, he will try to deodorize his administration, because he knows for a fact that the label dictator's son will always be there. But of course, he will try nevertheless to justify the repression under Duterte. And for the same reason that he is all praises for his father, he is also, very much in high regard to the past president, even if the past president didn't see him that much of a candidate. He was even accused of being, a drug addict. But nevertheless, these are very, very serious times for media. It's not just Rappler that's affected under the Duterte administration. Just recently, our websites, Bulatlat and Pinoy Weekly, two of the alternative news media organizations, were shut down because of the blocking of our websites, apparently upon the orders of the powers that be. We were red-tagged once more. So we would see that kind of continuity. So that's why the pushback would have to happen even within the ranks of media. That's mm-hmm. the difference between the Marcos and Duterte administrations. In the past, the media were not harassed so much. But right now, the red tagging has become so intense that even journalists mm-hmm. Who are critical of the administration, they are affected by red tagging.
Richard, you mentioned earlier the alliance between the two powerful dynasties, the Duterte, Sara Duterte, and Marcos Jr., which paved the way for Marcos to take over. In this case, is he going to end up being politically beholden to Sara Duterte for the rest of his tenure?
You know, I agree with Danilo that, I mean, if you look at the Marcoses, they will try to deodorize, for instance, to make themselves look good internationally, right? I mean, look at his inauguration speech. It was mostly in English, very sophisticated prose. You had a lot of high-level dignitaries. So he wants to improve the world. And in the same way, that kind of strategy, I think they'll also apply to the other rivals or allies, for that matter. I mean, on one hand, of course, the Marcoses will say we're allies for life. That's exactly what presidential sister Aimee Marcos, Senator Marcos, said. We're going to be allies for life with the Dutertes. They attended the inauguration of Sara Duterte in the South. They said, we'll take care of you. But at the same time, if you look at Marcos, in his first hours after he won the presidency the other month, he didn't give Sara Duterte the cabinet position she was asking for, which was the Department of National Defense. Instead, Marcos chose to give it, for instance, to a former general, more traditionalist persons. He didn't give the Department of Foreign Affairs to loyalists. He gave it to traditionalists. And then in the Speaker of the House, for instance, everyone thought he's going to give it, for instance, to former President Arroyo, one of the key allies during the campaign that brought the two houses together. He didn't give it to her. In fact, he supported his own cousin, Martin Romualdez, to take over the Speaker of the House. What does it say? It says that the Marcoses will try to do the bare minimum to avoid major divisions, fault lines, and fights with other houses. But at the same time, they'll try to consolidate their own hold on power and push their own agenda. And I think if ever Marcos pushes for constitutional change, that's where we're going to see a lot of divisions. Definitely the Dutertes want more federalism, more decentralization of power. But Marcos may have his own ideas about a strong centralized state.
Alvin, tomorrow, the president will have to deal with issues such as a country which ranks poorly when it comes to the global corruption assessment, which is suffering from underdeveloped infrastructure. How can he move forward to rebuild this country?
So he would likely continue the Duterte government's focus on infrastructure. So getting a lot of foreign government loans, particularly from China, the Asian Development Bank and Japan, and pushing the budget to sort of like financing a lot of these projects. So the Duterte government pursued a budget deficit strategy called the build, build, build. Marcos will likely do the same. And to some extent, this harkens back to how his father governed the Philippines in the 1960s to the 1980s. I think the focus on infrastructure is really, really important. If it is done successfully, it can lead to employment. It employs people. It rewards local business elites because infrastructure projects will have to be coordinated between international players and domestic players. It builds his legitimacy because it makes it appear he is doing something. And more importantly, it creates a legacy for him and his family, for his for the Marcoses to continue on winning future elections should his son or like sister run for higher positions.
Danilo, in a way or another, if you would like to whitewash the legacy of your father, you need projects. You need to bring the nation something new. In this particular case, you have a president who takes over a nation which has been massively hit by COVID-19 pandemic. 60,000 Filipinos were killed in that. And you have an economy which is moving towards a recession. And you have an inflation which is causing huge problems for the country. How do you see him getting enough revenues to be able to implement some of the pledges he made during his election campaign?
Well, based on recent policy pronouncements, we're seeing more taxes to be, you know, levied, not against the rich, but more indirect taxes. So that would hit the poor more. And of course, more debt, more dependence on foreign investments. And if you go by the appointments of the next set of economic leaders right now, they have a more neoliberal and globalist perspective. So we can see here more continuity in terms of export-oriented growth, foreign investment-led economy, and something that's debt-dependent. So that's why it's going to be very, very challenging for the poor and even the middle class if they don't get the aid that they need. And the micro and small and medium enterprises will also suffer as a result. I don't want to be a doomsayer here, but right now, things are really not so promising insofar as the Philippine economy would be concerned. And part of the reason is that Duterte has accumulated so much debt, apparently because of the COVID-19 response, but how to pay it back, future generations of Filipinos will have to do that. And in fact, paying back the massive foreign debt will even go beyond the Marcos regime.
Richard, Marcos will inherit from the Duterte the bloody war on the drug policy and the settlements that he made with the rebel groups. Do you see him continuing with that legacy, or do you see him charting his own course?
Right. As far as I know, I mean, based on conversation with some of his cabinet members, I mean, there are a lot of internal debates, and I think Marcos' policy is still fluid. How is he going to stand on things? In fact, even on the infrastructure issue, which scholars like Alvin have extensively written on, there's an internal debate on whether they're going to go public-private partnership or they're going to rely more on foreign financing and government financing, and also on the issue of taxation. Should they increase the taxes? They have fiscal consolidation. Now, on the drug war, I believe there's also going to be a lot of internal discussion. So the Dutertes, including Vice President Sara Duterte, who's also Department of Education Secretary, and other loyalists of Duterte, will push for the continuation of the drug war almost a status quo. But Marcos himself recognizes that the drug war has been a big headache for the Philippines, bad headlines. It undermines rule of law. It turns off a lot of investors. So he has suggested actually that he may tweak it a little bit. For instance, more focus on surgical operations against big fish, drug lords, right? More focus on rehabilitation. So I think at least on the optics level, he's going to make some changes and tweaks so that things will look better. But the big question, though, is will he allow the International Criminal Court to investigate the drug war under the previous president, because that could potentially lead to the prosecution of the previous president create conflict within coalition.
Alvin, let's talk foreign policy here. When it comes to China, on one hand, he badly needs support from the Chinese government, but do you think that this is a moment where he will have to distance himself from China and embrace more of American policies?
I don't think so. I feel like people have written that Duterte, Marcos is going to be, following the footsteps of Duterte. And I feel like that's partially true in as much as the Marcos government will need the Chinese government. At the same time, he will also need the American government. You will always have, institutionally, the Philippines will always be tied to the United States, whether it's about exporting labor to the United States or foreign direct investment or trade. You can never disconnect from the United States. At the same time, there is a question of political survival and a question of like coalitional politics here. China does give opportunities to the Marcos government to reward local elites through particular foreign projects, or through some other mode of financing. And as much as I agree that as well, and this goes back to infrastructure, in as much as I agree that it is fluid, and I've done field work here both in Davao and in Ilocos Norte when I was finishing my PhD, there is always a question of how do you reward your local elites? How do you extend your power as the president? And to me, that goes back to having foreign financing, whether it's a budget deficit strategy or it's a public-private financing. It's all about rewarding local elites to keep yourself in power.
Danilo, is he going to be, in a way or another, overshadowed by the maritime territorial disputes with China? And we know that recently they have had an issue, particularly about the joint exploration of energy in the South China Sea, which they decided to shelve because of huge differences. Is this something which is going to definitely have an impact on his future relationship with China?
Yes, definitely. And as the two gentlemen mentioned, the relationship with China will still be there. It remains to be seen whether or not Marcos will pursue an independent foreign policy and whether or not he would have the political will to do so. For the simple reason that it is for the rich and powerful's interest to maintain close relations with China, given that investments coming from that particular country has come in several folds right now, and they've practically invested in various sectors. That's not to say that they are surpassing the presence of U.S. transnational corporations in the country. So I think it will be a tough balancing act for the new administration to maintain stronger ties with China on one hand, but at the same time still have relations with other countries, especially the United States.
Richard, in less than 20 seconds, 1986, Aquino took over after the departure of Marcos. People thought this was going to be the end of dictatorship. Now it's the return of the Marcos. How do you see the future of Philippines?
I think if the opposition doesn't get its act together, if they don't learn the right lessons and do the proper postmortem, the most likely outcome for the Philippines is what political scientists call a hybrid regime. The Philippines could end up more like neighboring countries like Malaysia or faraway countries like Hungary and Turkey, whereby you have semi-competitive elections, semi-free media, but you know who's going to rule the country, which coalition will be in charge for the foreseeable future.
Richard Hedarian, Alvin Kamba, Danilo Arau, thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate your insight. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Hashim Albarra, and the entire team here in Doha. Bye for now.